Intelligent Medicine is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and healthy eaters get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/Hoffman to support the show and see if you qualify. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. And it's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer questions. Questions can come to us via radioprogram@AOL.com. And we mentioned the question last hour, but you can summarize. This is a gentleman who
is following
a ketogenic diet, he says?
Yeah, he's on a low-carb diet, keeps him in low-level ketosis. He's a 72-year-old male who was recently diagnosed with diverticulitis. Took a round of antibiotics. It's all resolved, but he's very concerned about a recurrence and what he can do to prevent that.
Okay.
Well.
Okay, so first thing about it is of interest that he's on a ketogenic diet because he, and I guess it depends on how he's implementing the ketogenic diet, but the ketogenic diet does eliminate some of the foods that we might want to eliminate for patients with diverticulitis. We actually mostly want to put patients with diverticulitis on something called a specific carbohydrate diet.
Yes.
Which is... You know, perhaps you can explain what that is.
Yeah, the specific carbohydrate diet eliminates disaccharides, polysaccharides, starches, and sugars that can irritate the gut. And what happens
and also
is...
That are fermentable. And that cause a proliferation of bacteria.
Exactly.
And the problem is bacterial overgrowth in diverticulitis.
Right, right. So by removing food groups like the grains in its entirety, this is not just gluten-free. All the grains are gone. Potatoes are gone. Soybeans are gone. Certain other starchier vegetables, at least in the beginning, are gone. Basically, however, you've got the gamut of protein, your animal protein, your poultry, your fish, all of your vegetables that are mostly non-starchy. You've got fruit as well, and nuts and seeds, as opposed to the conventional wisdom of if you have diverticulosis, which are those pockets in the colon where food bits get trapped and can cause diverticulitis, which is acute, best to stay away from nuts and seeds. But that's since been debunked.
It has been debunked. Yeah, that there's no studies do not show a triggering effect of those food particles.
And those with our patients who have had diverticulitis in the past, we put them on the specific carbohydrate diet, and their diverticulitis goes away. It doesn't happen, and they're eating nuts and seeds.
Yep.
And even the seeds of tomatoes and strawberries. And things like that. They're not having a problem.
I will comment on this, is that some people have such a damaged intestine that it is beyond the capacity of diet to fix.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like saying, you know, you got a worn out sock and it's got some really thinned out places. And how you can prevent a hole from developing in that sock? Well, you know, you could say, well, very careful walking, you know, very real attention to, you know, your shoes and your walking style. And, you know, you get more mileage out of your socks. But if your intestine's really physically damaged, you may end up having to have a surgery to remove that part of the intestine. It may be beyond the capability of the diet to help.
You got to throw out the sock.
You basically cut out the part that's full of holes and you sew the ends together.
Right.
And these aren't actually holes, but they're out pocketings.
They need to be, rewoven.
Yeah. Now, so I would say we have about a 50-50 track record with our patients. We've had some who've been absolutely free of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I had dinner with one of them the other night, and I saw he ate very carefully because I was sitting there. But also he'd had surgery for diverticulitis, and the doctors said you're cured, and he had experienced still a lot of pain. And I said, well, I don't know if we want to reoperate on you. I think we got it all out. And I, you know, we came to me and he said, I don't want another operation. I said, well, here, do this, follow the SCD. And, you know, we gave him certain supplements, which we can talk about. And he's been fine.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he used to have crippling attacks. He travels a lot. He was having crippling attacks on the plane and while traveling, and it was really a disaster.
Winding up in various hospitals wherever you travel.
You don't want to be, you know, in like Romania or Morocco and, you know, but.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it's the diet, but it's all certain supplements can be beneficial, and among those are things that sort of keep the intestinal tract, keep the bacterial overgrowth at bay.
Yeah.
Among the things that are helpful, oregano oil, oil of oregano. It's available in various supplements. Mm-hmm. It can be a little harsh for some people, so milder is the berberine.
Berberine
is used as a disinfectant for the gastrointestinal tract. Yeah. It keeps the population of bacteria down.
Mm-hmm. And we like anti-inflammatory.
Probiotics.
For that, probiotics.
Yeah.
Fish oil, the enterocoated fish oil, so it gets to where it needs to go.
For healing, right.
Healing, curcumin.
Yeah. In a way, similar to ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, but it's a different thing.
A different thing. But, I've seen great success with following this specific plan, the specific carbohydrate diet, and for diverticulitis.
It's worth a try. Yeah, you know, if you're scheduled, I mean, hopefully it's not emergency surgery, but the doctor may say, look, you've had so many attacks, we're going to schedule you for surgery this summer. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe you'll have a little more time off from work. So you got, you know, you're waiting. It's not emergency surgery, it's elective surgery.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is the rule in a lot of countries. Like in Canada, they say, oh, you have diverticulitis. We can do you in 2019. Get in line. Or in the National Health Service in England. It's not an emergency. So they say, well, we'll do the surgery. You need the surgery, but we'll do it in, in October, you know.
Right.
So, but for people who are queued up for that kind of surgery, it's sometimes worth a trial of the diet because come time for surgery, maybe you can say, doc, you know, I'm feeling so good. I'm not having a twinge of this. Maybe we can put it on the back burner and you can see if you can go longer.
Yeah.
The risk, though, is that some people fall off the wagon and they start eating, you know,
a sandwich,
bad stuff. And pretty soon the bacteria proliferate and change the flora and the creatine imbalance, dysbiosis in the intestinal tract. Mm-hmm. And then the out-pocketings start to flare.
Yeah. So, Mark, that would be an integrative approach so that you can prevent a future recurrence. You should call for a consult. 212-779-1744. Thank you for your question. All right. Let's see.
I endorse this message.
I endorse this. Right. I approve this message.
Right.
We have an email We have an email from Steve. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. My wife is currently 12 weeks pregnant and was tested for very high levels of B12 in her blood, greater than 1,000 p.m. per liter. There was a recent study indicating high levels of B12 were associated with autism. I've read that you can have high levels and still be deficient because of genetic issues with B12 transport, like MTHFR. Should she stop taking her multi, which has 200 micrograms of methyl cobalamin? Basically, what the study found that Steve has sent us was
You looked up the study.
Yeah, I looked up the study. That there was a U-shaped relationship between maternal multivitamin supplementation frequency and risk of autism spectrum.
Where was this study from?
This study was from Boston Medical Center.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Included 1,257 mother-child pairs who were recruited at birth and prospectively followed.
Right.
And let's see. Maternal plasma folate, B12, were measured from samples taken 2 to 3 days after birth. And basically, they took self-reported supplementation during pregnancy from the mothers.
Right.
And what they found was that those who were taking very high amounts of plasma, maternal plasma folate at birth had 2.5 times increased risk
of autism. So one thing I will explain is that I sometimes see people who take no folate and don't eat a lot of vegetables, and they have very high folate.
Yeah.
And I go, ask myself, why is that? Why should they have high? They don't even hardly eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, which is a major source of folate. Also liver, but they don't eat liver.
Right.
And they have high levels. And so the answer is that it is high folate is a marker for dysbiosis.
Mm.
It's a marker for bacterial overgrowth.
The last thing they found not only 2.5 times more with folate, higher risk of autism, but also 2.5 times increased risk with high B12.
Okay.
The question was about B12. That's why I'm
right,
kind of circling
back
to the B12.
That, yeah.
But yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I don't know but whether B12 is a little less likely to be synthesized by your gastrointestinal flora.
Mm.
But I will say this, is I asked you where that study is from,
mm-hmm.
and it's from Boston, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here's another one that just came out. This is January 2018. Taking vitamins before and during pregnancy slashes autism risk by 75%, a mm-hmm. new study shows. So that kind of contradicts that. It says, yeah. a new study shows that taking either folic acid or multivitamins before or during pregnancy cuts the risk of children developing autism by 73%. Mm. This study was performed at Haifa University in Israel, and it examined 43,000 children whose mothers had or had not taken supplements during pregnancy. Mothers who took multivitamins up to 2 years before pregnancy also reduced the risk by 61%. So that's interesting, is that
yeah.
even if they stopped and they did up to 2 years before, they reduced by 61%.
What's interesting on this, the Boston study, is because there's a U-shaped relationship between maternal multivitamin supplementation and frequency of autism, there apparently is a sweet spot in between there. Too low,
mm-hmm.
autism prevalence may be higher.
Right.
If you're too high, autism prevalence can be higher. So there appears to be a just right.
Right.
A Goldilocks
okay.
point with much of this. So that's
But they didn't report that in the study in
yeah.
From Israel.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
the take home message is that it's okay to take a multivitamin or folic acid mm-hmm. if you're Jewish. But you know, I don't know.
There you go, Steve.
I think that's the practical the practical message here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is very interesting. Well, Steve, this is one for your wife to follow up with her obstetrician and take it from there. Maybe she needs to be tested for MTHFR.
Yeah, and
well,
it's I think that may have something to do with it, is mm-hmm. the ability to metabolize the B vitamins
yeah.
may have something to mm-hmm. there may be a relationship, and I don't
yeah.
know if that's been properly studied.
Right. And even though it's methylcobalamin that she's taking, it could be that she doesn't need this dose, even though it's only a 200 microgram dose.
Well, 200 micrograms is not
longer.
Much.
It's not.
Because 1,000 is what we typically inject, up to 2,000. You can get 5,000 orally.
Yes, you can. Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Under the tongue. Right.
So it sounds pretty conservative, 200 micrograms.
Yeah.
Yeah, 200 micrograms, 0.2 milligrams.
Yeah. And this doesn't count anything she's getting in her diet. She's having animal protein. She's
right.
certainly getting B12 from there
right.
as well. So, oh, Steve, best of luck with your wife's pregnancy. I hope she's feeling very well and happy.
By the way, I just want to share, parenthetically, I want to share an alert with patients who are out there taking metformin. I know there are a lot of people who are pre-diabetic or diabetic. Taking metformin. We even prescribe metformin for some of our cancer patients because of its cancer preventive capabilities.
Yeah.
And I had a guy who, because he had cancer, I didn't want to give him a lot of B vitamins. My theory, and some people believe that if you give a lot of B vitamins, excess B vitamins to people who have had cancer, that you may, it's a growth factor.
Yeah.
You know, it'll make your hair grow and people are real
yeah.
happy about that. But it may cause cells to proliferate and we don't want that in a cancer.
Right.
So this guy's been doing very well under her care for the last 10 years with mm-hmm. prostate cancer. It was pretty advanced at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so he checks in. I give him metformin to prevent prostate cancer. I told him not to take B vitamins. And he comes in, we check his B12, and it's 200.
Yeah.
Which is pretty close to the threshold of deficiency
mm-hmm.
because metformin depletes B12.
Yes.
So if you're taking metformin, you probably should take a little B12.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting there, too, is his homocysteine went up as a result of the deficiency.
Yep.
He had a nice optimal homocysteine, which then went back up to about 11
right.
and a half or something, which now will come back down.
Right. So
with some
this guy's doing
B
so well with his prostate cancer. We don't want him to develop neuropathy from the
yeah.
B12 or, you know, cognitive decline or have a high homocysteine, which could be lead to
right.
Cerebrovascular risk, particularly risk of stroke or blood clots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcasts into, well, we allow our, sorry, we take that back. We've already divided our podcasts, but we're now allowing our sponsors an opportunity to share a message with you. So here goes.
As a health-conscious person, you're going to love our new sponsor, HealthIQ. HealthIQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, strength trainers, healthy eaters, and more. The HealthIQ advantage is their unique mortality model on the health-conscious and lower rates for health-conscious people, like a good driver savings on auto insurance. They also have unique underwriting that's tailored to the needs of the health-conscious, so things like having an adverse family history won't typically drive your rates up. You can actually qualify for up to 33% savings by doing things like taking a health IQ quiz and scoring elite, having a membership to a qualifying association or gym for more than 1 year, and more. Health IQ believes the best way to improve the health of the world is to celebrate the health conscious rather than penalizing those who are not. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/Hoffman or mention the promo code Hoffman when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Even if you don't qualify, HealthIQ will use their world-class underwriting team and shop the nation's top 30 carriers to get you the lowest retail rate in the market. So don't miss your chance to save up to 33% in your life insurance and check out healthiq.com/Hoffman to see if you qualify today.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what makes this podcast a possibility for you as a free resource. And now, let's get back to questions.
Okay, we've got an email from Rona. My daughter-in-law, age 40, needs gallbladder surgery. What might be the best protocol for her prior to surgery and directly following surgery to help ensure a good result and promote faster healing? She's got two little ones at home, a six-month-old son and a two-and-a-half-year-old son, who both need lifting in and out of car seats and cribs, so the faster she heals, the better. She can't lift them for, what, 6 weeks after a surgery?
That's
like
about
that?
The usual time, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So this surgery is another surgery that has been on the rise for, I guess, many, many reasons.
And it's actually not a coincidence. This is how many kids she's had now?
She's had two.
Two. So she's probably 40. She has some of the risk factors that we call them the four Fs. She's probably female.
Uh-huh.
She's probably approaching 40.
Yeah.
And she's fertile.
Fertile, yes.
So there's a lot of estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And she might be a little on the overweight side, which predisposes.
If she has a 6-month-old, she may be.
Which predisposes to gallbladder disease. And sometimes FAIR is also the fifth F. But there's actually a less prevalence of gallbladder disease in African Americans than in Caucasians. But there's a higher prevalence in other non-fair people, like Hispanics, and especially in people who have Native American ancestry.
Really?
Very high prevalence. Among the Pima, the Navajos,
yes,
on reservations and in Arizona and New Mexico, the descendants of the Native Americans have a very high incidence of gallbladder disease, possibly because they have a higher incidence of insulin resistance. So, you know, I wrote a series of articles on this last year, and, you know, you're welcome to look at them, but they don't speak to this issue. They speak more to prevention of gallbladder disease. She's got gallbladder disease. She's going to have surgery.
Yes.
So she needs the surgical surgical protocol, surgery protocol. You know, so what would you give to somebody for surgical healing?
For surgical healing afterwards, definitely bromelain or Wobenzyme to prevent adhesion, scar tissue, on the order of 9 per day.
That's so three times a day.
Away from meals, because you don't want those enzymes to digest your food. Mm-hmm. They have to be at least 2 hours away from food.
Right.
So that they're digesting.
Food will interfere.
Yeah, food will interfere with it. Other things, and after any surgery or any trauma-like surgery, your protein needs are increased. So eating well even prior to, so that you're in good shape before surgery as well.
But, you know, when people have gallbladder surgery, they're encouraged to eat light meals afterwards because it takes a while for the body to adjust to not having a gallbladder.
You can't eat the amount of fats that you did recently because there may be a tendency to have diarrhea after the surgery, which should clear up. The body will readjust after several months.
That's right.
The gallbladder is a depot where the bile, which is secreted from the liver, goes to hang out. And that gallbladder is contracted every time we have some fat in our food that we've just eaten. But now that that depot is gone, the liver is secreting this bile, and sometimes it's becoming too much of a, maybe a lube job. in the gut in the beginning until it readjusts itself.
So is there a need for high pancreatic enzymes or something, perhaps in the immediate aftermath, perhaps?
That's helpful.
To help with digestion.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps also using some vitamin C and zinc to help with healing. Because we know that surgery is a form of trauma, and we know that demands for C go up and demands mm-hmm. for zinc go up in terms of wound healing.
Mm-hmm.
These would be helpful.
These are helpful. Magnesium goes down with any surgery. Taking some magnesium is also helpful.
Sure.
Not too much if you're having diarrhea, but...
Right.
Yeah.
And, it's an insult to the GI tract. You know, maybe taking a good quality probiotic may help.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there's some suggestion that probiotics may reduce the risk of gallbladder stone formation because they help with the enterohepatic circulation of bile. They mm-hmm. actually metabolize bile, some of them. So, and by the way, constipation is a risk factor for gallbladder stones, for bile stones.
That's interesting.
So wow. Cholesterol crystallization in bile stones.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would also say that having had gallbladder surgery should be a little bit of a shot across this woman's bow, because there's a high correlation between gallbladder disease and cardiometabolic risk.
Mm.
And it appears that the same people who get gallbladder disease in their maybe 40s may be the people who are going to get cardiovascular disease and prediabetes and diabetes ultimately in their 60s and 70s.
Wow.
So that if you say, well, gee, I used to have all these attacks and now I can eat with impunity, beware, because you might actually gain a lot of weight once you don't have any gallbladder attacks and you feel like, these foods don't bother me anymore. I would get on a really clean diet.
Yes.
A low-carb Mediterranean-style diet, like mm-hmm. the salad and salmon diet.
Mm-hmm. Something with plenty of
fiber. And minimize refined carbohydrates with lots of plant fiber.
Yes.
And things like olive oil, mm-hmm. that would be advisable. And not so much in terms of how quickly you're going to recover, but in terms of your long-term prospects of avoiding disease.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And to add, Rona, inform your daughter-in-law if she's on any supplements prior to surgery, the blood thinning ones are the ones to stop about a week or two prior to any surgery if she's taking a lot of fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
If she's on any aspirin therapy or uses aspirin often. Or flax oil, or high amounts of vitamin E.
Ginkgo biloba.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
These are some of the blood thinning ones. However, what would you say to her, once she's doesn't have, she's able to eat again,
mm-hmm.
within a week she can start taking fish oil again?
Maybe not quite yet, maybe not a week, especially if she's going to have diarrhea, which happens often enough.
Yeah.
After.
But this is, since it's an oil-based thing, it might be less well tolerated.
Yes.
But actually, there's some signs that taking fish oil in the post-surgical period
mm-hmm.
helps with reducing the inflammation.
And, there we go.
Yeah.
So there's a good reason for that. Probably just starting at a low dose and increasing as tolerated is probably advisable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, it looks like we've run the clock here on today's edition of Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for your questions, and keep sending them. We have a few more in the hopper, but we certainly need more grist for the mill for our future editions of Q&A with Layla. So keep sending questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. And thank you, Layla, for joining me today.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you, everybody.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.